They tumbled and plunged through a twisting, writhing tunnel made of raving, shrieking energy. Everyone suffered an assault on their senses, sight, hearing, touch, and taste. For a long, terrifying moment, they felt their bodies dissolve, then reform. There was nothing to see but a raging torrent of light, wild plumes and whirling spindrifts of violet, of yellow, of blue, and green and red. They swirled like a whirlpool, glowing filaments that congealed and stretched outward into the black gulfs of space. Streaks of gray and dark blue became interspersed with the colorful swirls. Bursts of light flared in garish displays on the tunnel walls. They felt themselves plummeting through an alternately brightly lit and shadow-shrouded abyss, an endless fall into infinity. They were conscious of a half-instant of whirling vertigo as if they hurtled a vast distance at blinding speed. Then the sensation of a free fall lessened. Slowly, as if veils were being drawn away one by one, the darker colors on the tunnel walls deepened and collected ahead of them into a pool of shimmering radiance. Brigid, Kane, and Grant stepped out of the energy field. Majira tumbled out of it, falling and rolling awkwardly across the stone floor. She remained prone, hanging her head like a dog, face concealed by her hair. She seemed completely disoriented and out of breath. The cascade of light whirled and spun like a diminishing cyclone, shedding sparks and thread-thin static discharges. As quickly as it appeared, the glowing cone vanished, as if it had been sucked back into the apex of the interphaser. Kane and Grant automatically dropped into crouches, bringing their copperheads to bear. The close assault weapons were stripped-down autoblasters. Gas-operated, with a 700-round-per-minute rate of fire, the magazines held 15 rounds of 4.85-millimeter steel-jacketed bullets. 2 feet in length, the weapon featured a grip and trigger unit placed in front of the breech to allow for one-handed use. An optical image intensifier scope was fitted on top, as well as a laser auto-targeter. The two men swung the barrels in short left-to-right arcs, questing for dangers or targets. All they saw were the clusters of black, human-shaped statues frozen in distorted poses. Brigid glanced behind her at the interphaser. The metal exterior of the pyramid was laced with a skein of electricity.
Smooth transit.
Kane and Grant surveyed the chamber, noting it was much larger than it had appeared on the remote probe's recording. Stalactites hung down like stone draperies from the arched ceiling far above. Feeble light glimmered from the overhead shadows, and to their dismay, they saw that the source of the ectoplasmic illumination came from a small square panel of a glassy substance inset in the ceiling. All of them had seen the light panels at one time or another. They were of Archon technology, a self-perpetuating light source that appeared to need no batteries or recharging. The glow of the light panel showed the outlines of bas-reliefs on the walls, blurred by the merciless hand of time. Otherwise, the chamber was empty, except for a few unidentifiable fragments of old metal and dust swept into corners. The crate tucked beneath the spiral staircase was easily visible. The NASA logo was legible, as well as the word Devil. The staircase itself was made of some kind of alloy like aluminum. Welds rose like scar tissue on the risers, and all of them knew it was a very late addition to the chamber. The doorway at the head of the stairway was crudely cut, ruining one of the bas-reliefs. The cold, moist air reeked with a strange, repellent odor, like mildewed clothes mixed in with sour milk. A faint, foul breeze touched their faces. It flowed in from the open door atop the spiral staircase. As Kane reached down to pick up Majira, for the first time it really sank in. He'd lain awake most of the night thinking about it, but the concept hadn't seemed real until that very moment. He and his friends were 238,866 miles from Earth, inside a place that smelled like moldy old clothes and dairy products gone bad. He fought down a choking claustrophobia. He noticed, however, that his body didn't feel appreciably lighter. In fact, he seemed to weigh actually a little more than he had when he'd stepped into the gateway unit in Cerberus Redoubt. Closing a hand around Majira's upper arm, he pulled her to her feet. He glanced over at Grant and saw him frowning, hefting his copperhead in both hands as if he were trying to guess its weight.
There's an artificial gravity generator in use. More than likely, it's the same kind of gravstatter we found in the Cydonia 1 compound. For some reason, it's notched higher than 1G.
She wrinkled her nose.
Mars smelled better than this place.
Grant sniffed the air experimentally, but said nothing. His nose had been broken 3 times in the past, and always poorly reset. Unless an odor was extraordinarily pleasant or virulently repulsive, He was incapable of detecting subtle smells unless they were right under his nostrils. A running joke during his mag days had been that Grant could eat a hearty dinner with a dead skunk lying on the table next to his plate. Bridget stepped over to Majira.
Remember, you gave us your word to afford a safe passage to your council chambers.
I did. We are here.
This? This place is your...
The rest of Bridget's words clogged in her throat as Majira suddenly threw herself backward against Kane, sidekicking Bridget in the belly in the same motion. Bridget jackknifed at the waist, blurting out a cry of surprise. She staggered back against Grant, who was forced to let his copperhead dangle by the strap so he could use both hands to keep her from falling. With wire-taut reflexes, astonishing in someone so old, Majira twisted and wrenched herself free of Kane's grasp. She slammed both hands flat against his chest, shoving him into one of the black statues. Hairline cracks appeared in the black body, and from them spewed tendrils of equally black smoke. At the same time, an astringent stench filled Kane's nostrils, an odor of hot sulfur mixed with ammonia. The cracks in the statue's body expanded into deep splits, and more of the oily vapor plumed out. The smoke spread quickly, and the figure seemed to unravel at the edges, twists of mist rising like a multitude of loose black threads. Clothing, flesh, bones, and hair dissolved into a foul-smelling fog. Kane stumbled backward as he was showered with foul-smelling ash and blinded by the black mushroom of smoke. He inhaled a mouthful of vapor and succumbed to a coughing fit. Grant, coughing and sputtering, glimpsed Majira at the top of the staircase an instant before she lunged through the door. Although he couldn't fully smell the cesspit stink from the destroyed statue, the foul tang of sulfur was sharp on his tongue. He turned his head and spit.
Now, what do we...
Bridget guessed what he was going to ask.
We can't stay here. It'll take the interphaser another few minutes to finish its cycle. Majira will probably be back here with a squad of Furies in about 30 seconds.
Grant plunged through the settling smoke and ash, eyes narrowed to slits.
And let's not hang around. We can meet them halfway. Bring the interphaser.
Bridget bent and picked up the machine.
I don't think that's a good idea. What if we're captured and it's taken away from us? Damaged beyond repair. I'll hide it instead.
Kane glanced around the room. Except for the figures of calcified people, the big chamber was essentially featureless.
Hide it where?
Bridget nibbled her lower lip for a couple of seconds, eyes darting this way and that. Then she smiled and strode among the black statues. She stopped before one roughly in the center of the cluster. Its arms were raised as if in fear, crossed over the upper body. Carefully, Bridget fitted the interphaser into the cradle formed by the biceps and upper chest. Kane smiled in approval. The weak, watery illumination in the chamber was so dim and the figure placed in such a way that someone would have to be standing literally beside it in order to see the device. Grant was already scaling the staircase, taking two steps at a time.
Let's go!
The stairs led to a dimly lit passageway, looking as if it had been hacked out of stone and reinforced with braces of thick, bevel-edged beams of iron. They paused long enough to put on dark-lensed glasses. The electrochemical polymer of the lenses gathered all available light and made the most of it to give them a limited form of night vision. All three of them carried Nighthawk microlights, but they were loath to use them, fearing the glows they produced would pinpoint their position to anyone coming down the dark passageway ahead of them. The three people moved swiftly and fairly silently, the boots of their shadow suits making only faint rasping sounds. They stepped over irregularities in the floor and came across branching mouths of other tunnels. They passed a number of the light panels inset into the walls. They moved steadily ahead, none of them caring for the cold, damp breeze that wafted over them from somewhere in the darkness ahead. From that darkness came odd, faint sounds. Very brief, but very eerie. As they strode forward, Kane's imagination could not help but weave visions from the sounds, whispering and echoing. Now and then he heard an eerie sobbing cry, then a mechanical clanking, and then a distant wail, like the wind through distant pines. At other times, he thought he sensed presences in the black mouths of the side passages. The skin of Kane's nape prickled. He was conscious of the gaze of unseen eyes. Their ears detected a distant, almost inaudible reverberation. The throbbing drone grew louder the farther they walked, like the murmur from a far-off crowd. Kane found himself wishing Domi hadn't decided to stand down from the op. Her wilderness-honed senses would have been a great asset at this point. He couldn't blame her, particularly considering how the last recon mission she had undertaken turned out. He was fairly certain, however, that her refusal had more to do with being in Grant's company than shrinking from possible dangers. The hum grew louder, and the tunnel brightened as they approached what appeared to be a large chamber. The three Cerberus exiles moved forward cautiously and found themselves on a balcony. Below them was the source of the throbbing drone, a two-tiered generator. The sight of the strangely shaped generator was no surprise, considering their location. They had seen identical machines in several places across the world over the past 2 years. The generator derived from the same source as the light panels, Balaam's people. Brigid stepped to the far side of the balcony, toward a framed portal with metal shutters on the wall. Thin, regularly shaped slits of white light were visible between the metal slats. Brigid slowly began to turn a knob on the frame, and the shutters opened, allowing the threads of light to widen. Grant and Kane moved beside her, narrowing their eyes until their vision became accustomed to the brightness.
Now you can get your bearings, Kane.
Dawn was creeping across the outer face of the moon, the advancing sunlight flowing like a slow orange tide over the stark, peak-ringed craters and bone-white pumice plains. Two lunar peaks towered over them like the calcified finger bones of inestimably huge giants. Cruel, jagged escarpments and buttresses glared blindingly white in the unrelenting brilliance of the unsoftened sun. Grant bit back a curse, and Kane stiffened. The airless surface of the moon seemed to meet deep space with its billions of glittering stars. Reflecting back the light of distant suns, the broken surface of the moon stood out in stark relief. There was no blanket of atmosphere to soften and spread either the light of Sol or the glow from the stars. Here was either too much sun, if you were on the sun side, or not enough. Looking outward, Kane felt he could actually see the literal meaning of infinity, the vast gulfs of space stretching onward and onward until the mind flinched from trying to measure it. Brigid reached between the shutters and touched a thick portal made of armaglass.
Over there is Mare Frigoris, the Sea of Ice. It's called that because the surface is vitrified.
In silence, they watched the dawn tide creep across the face of the moon. When it touched the fused, glassine surface of Mare Frigoris, it slowly lit up to blinding brilliance. They recoiled, and Brigid hastily closed the shutters. For a long moment, none of them spoke, trying to reconcile the concept of traveling to the moon with the reality of actually being there. Numbly, they moved back to the handrail. On the opposite side of the balcony from the shuttered portal, a metal spiral wound down through an opening in the floor. Kane craned his neck up and back, seeing only a crisscrossing pattern of pipes and conduits.
No way to go up, so I guess it's down. I figured we'd be fighting off an army of night gaunts by now, but this place seems deserted.
As if on cue, a faint noise emanated from below and commanded all of their attention. They dropped into crouches, peering down between the crossbars of the handrail. A man crept around the base of the generator. He was slightly below average height and was wearing a dark brown coverall. His complexion was of a similar hue, but he was not a Negro. His long black hair hung in lank strands, framing a deeply scarred face. He slunk along, stooped in a crouch, looking from side to side. The long-barreled pistol, grasped in one hand, trembled as if he were terrified. When he turned his head slightly, they caught the blaze of wild eyes.
He doesn't look like the Fury I unmasked in Chicago.
Whoever he is, he's scared to death of something.
But of what?
A shadow suddenly shifted on the other side of the generator, moving smoothly and silently behind the man. It paused for a second at the cube-shaped base, and a dark gray bulk rose up from the floor.
What the hell is that? Some kind of animal?
In shape, it was almost triangular. A smooth front rose up to an almost comically tiny head, set at the apex of the triangle. The back was a long slope that tapered down to the floor. It appeared to be about 6 feet long. Four legs were set under it, almost as a kickstand might be set beneath a motorcycle. Two tiny red eyes gleamed above a square snout and a mouth full of needle-tipped alloy-coated teeth.
It's not an animal. It's a droid, a robot.
The mechanoid stood silent for another moment. Then its head rose up on a segmented metal neck, turning this way and that as if it were smelling a breeze. It took one step, halted, took two more, and stopped again. The man continued to walk silently, unaware of the machine stalking him. The metal stalk of its neck abruptly lowered, sinking the head between its dull gray shoulders. Then it sprang. Brigid acted according to the first impulse of her compassionate nature. She swiftly pulled herself erect and leaned over the rail.
Look out!
The man wheeled around instantly before her cry could even begin to echo. He saw the mechanoid vaulting toward him as he fell backward beneath it. The long-barreled pistol in his hand made a noise like the cracking of a monster whip. A puff of smoke bloomed from the machine's underbelly in the split second before it landed directly atop the man. Brigid rushed to the staircase, evading Kane's restraining hand and ignoring Grant's urgent warning.
Wait.
She rushed down the three windings of the spiral staircase, hearing Kane and Grant pound the risers directly behind her. Brigid reached man and mechanoid a few seconds before her companions. Acrid smoke curled from seams split open all up and down its length. An odor that smelled somewhat familiar, but one she was unable to identify, wafted out with the smoke. A thick yellowish liquid spread out across the floor around the man's body. He lay limply, his head barely visible, his arms spread-eagled. The pistol lay near his right hand. Grant and Kane spread out, approaching the two bodies from opposite directions, barrels of their subguns trained on the robot. The targeting pippers of the laser sights shone like tiny pinheads of blood on its dark gray casing.
"Get away from that damn thing, Baptiste."
She retreated, giving both men clear fields of fire. They came forward cautiously, fingers hovering over the triggers of their copperheads. Neither man nor machine stirred. The photoreceptors that served as the robot's eyes were dark.
"Some kind of sect droid. Never heard of anything like this."
All three of them recalled how Lakesh spoke of military experiments with robotic security forces installed in the Totality Concept redoubts. They ended experimentation in the late 1990s because the robots didn't have the ability to generalize. The sect droids tended to kill any personnel who even slightly matched their programmed enemy profile. Lakesh claimed he witnessed a test where one of the droids killed a congressional aide because he wore a mustache similar to that of a known terrorist. Kane played the kill dot of the auto-targeter over a series of small numbers stamped on the machine's dorsal side. Beneath them were the words, Robotech 3000.
"Somebody manufactured this thing."
Grant touched the widening pool of viscous yellow fluid with the toe of a boot.
"What's this shit? Oil? Some kind of lubricant?"
Brigid knelt at its leading edge and sniffed.
"Doesn't smell like it."
She dipped the tip of a forefinger into it and brought the liquid close to her nose. Her face twisted, first in revulsion, then astonishment.
"Oh my God."
"What?"
"This smells like... I think it's bile."
The man beneath the droid suddenly jerked his arms and legs and uttered a deep groan. Carefully, Kane and Grant wrestled the triangular metal body of the machine up and off the man. It was heavy, but not less so than they expected. A gaping cavity was punched through its underside. From this leaked the thick fluid, and they glimpsed a glitter of broken circuitry within. Brigid retrieved the man's pistol and kept it trained on him during the process. She was by no means an expert on firearms, but even she knew the hand blaster was very unusual. It held the general configuration of a revolver, but instead of a cylinder, a small round ammo drum was fitted into the place where there was normally a trigger guard. There was no real trigger, just a curving switch set into the grip. The barrel was unusually long, nearly 10 inches in length. It was made of a lightweight alloy that resembled dulled chrome. Once the man was freed of the robot's weight, he propped himself up on his elbows and stared at the three people with wild, wide eyes. He moved his lips for several seconds as if he were trying to summon the strength to scream. Kane wondered if the sight of them had unseated his reason.
"Who are you? Where did you come from? You're not of Majira's brood, though you're dressed like them."
Kane smiled in a manner he hoped was reassuring.
"These old things? We figured they were the fashion statement of the day up here on the moon."
The man tried to lever himself into a sitting position. Then he grimaced, clutching at the right side of his chest. He coughed rackingly, putting a hand over his mouth. When he brought it away, a glob of pink saliva glistened in the palm.
"Broken rib. Punctured my lung, but I don't think it's serious."
He glared with unregenerate homicidal hatred at the robot and flung the sputum at it.
"Fucking Carnobot. Too fast for you, wasn't I?"
"Carnobot?"
The man looked toward her, his eyes flicking up and down her lissom, black-clad form in silent appraisal and appreciation.
"You're the one who warned me. Thanks."
"Do you have a name?"
"Last I heard, yeah. What about you? Do you have names?"
Kane made introductions all around. The man nodded to each of them in turn.
"Call me Eduardo. It's my name for the moment, but I'm thinking of changing it."
He extended a hand toward Brigid.
"Can I have my gun back, please?"
"Not yet. Not until we get some answers."
Eduardo made an attempt to rise, but he set his teeth on a groan, kneading his chest.
"We can't stay here. They'll be all around us now."
"Who is they?"
"Majira and her Furies, for one. More of them, for another. Our spies told us Majira disappeared yesterday, so we made an incursion. But I saw her not more than 10 minutes ago, rallying her troops.
Rallying her troops for what?
Teeth gritted against the pain, Eduardo pushed himself to his feet.
This isn't the time. We've got to get to the East Life Hutch module. I hate those filthy things.
He turned and circled the base of the generator. Kane, Bridget, and Grant exchanged a quick, questioning glance, then fell in at his heels. He led them into a labyrinth of pipes and wheel valves crisscrossing in all directions. Dismantled pieces of machinery lay scattered on the floor. The Cerberus exiles followed Eduardo through the metal maze, Grant bumping his head on low-hanging pipes more than once.
You son of a bitch!
Shh!
When he swore, Eduardo shushed him into silence. He kept turning his head to listen for sounds of pursuit and stared with burning, fearful intensity at every wedge of shadow they passed. The longer they walked, the more they noticed how light their bodies began to feel. Jumping over a length of tubing in his path, Kane nearly sailed headlong into the ceiling.
What the hell is going on?
We're getting farther and farther from the Grav Stator field. Don't worry about it, though. Worry about the Carnobots that may have caught our scent.
Droids can't smell.
These can. They used to be called gastrobots because they operated on E. coli-powered fuel cells.
A robot that runs on bacteria?
Not anymore. Now they're powered by meat.
Eduardo paused for a moment, panting, hand on his chest.
They derive power through a microbial fuel cell stomach. The stomach breaks down food using Escherichia coli bacteria and then converts the chemical energy from that digestion process into electricity. The microbes from the bacteria decompose the carbohydrates supplied by the food, which releases electrons. The electrons, in turn, supply a charge to the battery through a reduction and oxidation reaction. We call it redox.
It's crazy.
Eduardo was in too much pain and too out of breath to reply.
No, it makes sense. The system he describes is very similar to how blood supply and respiration works in humans, but the process produces electrons rather than oxygen. So the ideal fuel for powering such a mechanism is meat. It has its own digestive system, the synthetic bile.
Maybe. But how can it smell?
A lot better than we do. Nothing more than a sensor chip, like in smoke alarms. Except the Carnobots are programmed to detect perspiration and even pheromones.
Eduardo pushed himself off the wall and started walking.
And Majira controls them?
Bridget fell into step behind the man again.
Yeah, and a lot more than droids, too.
What's your problem with her?
Eduardo uttered a strange sobbing sound. It took a couple of seconds before they interpreted the vocalization as a scornful laugh.
Any of you ever heard of Charlemagne?
Only Bridget answered.
Yes.
Emperor Charlemagne passed savage laws against demons and all who held converse with them. For hundreds of years, the Catholic Church staged a brutal crusade against demonologists, torturing and executing thousands of people all over Europe with a fanaticism that was demonic itself.
Grant and Kane looked mystified.
So Majira has set herself up as Charlemagne and you're the demon?
Something like that.
You could have said so in the first place. Looks like you found a soulmate, Baptiste.
Bridget ignored Kane. Eduardo moved forward in an odd but swift shuffling gait. He led them to an open hatch in the floor and scurried down a wooden ladder.
This is an old drainage system, closed off for years. That's how my people got into this part of the base.
The four people splashed along a curve-walled conduit, wading ankle-deep in seepage, bypassing a dented and rust-streaked pumping station. As they strode along, all of them noticed the temperature was rising. Bridget guessed the Manetius base was in direct sunlight now.
At the halfway point.
Halfway point to where?
When Eduardo didn't answer, Grant took a long-legged step forward, reaching for the man. Due to the diminished gravity, he ended up slamming into him. Eduardo nearly went sprawling, but Grant grabbed him by the collar of his coverall and kept him on his feet.
Where are you taking us?
Eduardo winced, touching his chest, but he didn't try to rest free.
To my people. They're waiting for us. For the love of God, let me go. I'll tell you everything once we get there. Believe me, I'm just as curious about you as you are about me, but this isn't the time.
Grant glared at him for a silent, menacing second, then released him. The four people moved on again. The narrow conduit opened up on a long, low tunnel stretching away before them, iron I-beams shoring up the sides and ceiling. The ground was earthen, muddy, and damp, showing the prints of many feet. The smell of decaying vegetable matter clogged their nostrils. Eduardo strode swiftly to the end of the tunnel and came to a halt, looking around cautiously. The three Cerberus personnel joined him, gazing in astonishment at the vast, bowl-shaped chamber beyond. The walls and domed ceiling were composed of interlocking slabs of a transparent substance all of them recognized as armaglass. Outside the dome, they saw the Manetius base looming around them. Most of the installation was built into the regolith, the inner walls of the crater. It was a collection of towers and radar dishes and bulldozed flat plains bisected by terraced channels with concrete-paneled sides. Eduardo pointed.
One of those is our destination, the Life Hutch habitat modules.
They saw four smooth cylinders, each with a chute type of tunnel leading to it from a point they couldn't see. Each one was half dug into the side of the crater, presumably for shelter from radiation. Atop some of the towers were small directional dishes. From others, stairs on elevated girders climbed to pyramidal structures that were part of the solar cell energy array. The entire expanse was interlaced with thick power cables and conduits stretching along forked pylons.
Not much to look at, is it?
Depends on your perspective.
Eduardo gave her a jittery smile and moved out from the tunnel. The air was still and hot, thick with veils of steamy mist.
This is a hydroponic farm. It grows everything we need to keep us alive. This was the first place Majira claimed.
Bridget looked out at the walls of the crater looming above them and fanned away steam from her face.
Land of the Misty Mountains. Now I know what that meant.
They scaled a short ladder leading to a catwalk forming a narrow, elevated bridge between square fields of mossy earth dotted with warm pools of water. Below them were fruit trees, rows of corn, even carrot patches. At the end of the catwalk, Eduardo turned aside and sidled through a doorway that in turn led to a chamber from which a metal stairway spiraled down into darkness. Eduardo, panting from exertion and pain, pointed into the throat of blackness.
That goes to an access way below, then to the Life Hutch module. Majira and her Furies and maybe even a Carnabot or two might have gotten here ahead of us, but we must take the chance.
All of them quickly descended the winding stair and stepped into a corridor as impenetrably black as the gulfs between the stars. Their dark vision glasses were useless, and Kane fumbled for his Nighthawk microlight in a belt pouch. He turned it on, and the amber beam cast a halo on Eduardo's frightened face. Beads of perspiration glistened on his forehead like polished pearls.
No!
Eduardo clapped both hands around the little flashlight.
I know the way. If an ambush has been laid ahead, we can't let them know we're coming.
Kane hesitated, then clicked off the Nighthawk.
All right, but Grant will keep his blaster on you. Play us false, and you'll wish you were dealing with Carnobots.
Eduardo was too agitated to react to the threat.
Link hands.
Kane murmured in Bridget's ear.
Let me bring up the rear.
He stepped around her and clasped her right hand in his left. The four people began a silent march into absolute darkness. Kane suddenly heard a faint sound behind them. His flesh crawled as if an army of ants crept along between his skin and the shadow suit. He strained his ears, trying to catch a repetition of the stealthy movement in the corridor. He tried to pierce the blackness with slitted eyes. He saw nothing, and after a moment he was almost ready to attribute the sound to an errant echo and his wire-taut nerves. Then, in the sepia sea, two points of red fire appeared, seeming to dance and shift in a weird rhythm. He heard a distant tap-tapping. Between one heartbeat and the next, the tapping noise rose in volume to a steady clatter, and the crimson pinpoint swelled from the size of tiny embers to seething circles of scarlet. All of them heard the racket, and Eduardo yelped, a note of hysteria in his voice.
Run!
Grant spit out a curse, and Kane pushed Bridget aside, thumbing on the Copperhead's laser auto-targeting system. It cut through the darkness like a vermilion thread and touched something that winked metallically.
Go!
Grant put a hand between Bridget's shoulder blades and guided her along. They sprinted blindly down the corridor as the clatter grew louder and the scarlet spots drew closer. Their thudding footfalls echoed repeatedly. Kane ran as he'd run few times in his life. The breath seared his lungs and his heart pounded against his ribs. His laboring legs seemed weighted with half-frozen mud. Behind him, he heard the scuttle of metal against metal.
Here it is. It hasn't been opened.
help me?
Kane staggered to a halt, bumping into Bridget.
Help you do what?
The hatch. Help me open it.
Grant shouldered Eduardo aside, and his hands groped over a heavy metal door with a wheel lock centered in its rivet-studded mass. Putting both hands on the wheel, he turned it violently. The wheel didn't spin easily. It caught and squeaked during the rotation. He continued spinning until the lock completed its final turn and he heard the metallic snapping of solenoids and latches letting go. Putting his shoulder against it, he pushed the hatch open. Eduardo, Bridget, and Grant stumbled over the raised lip of the hatchway. Kane shoved Bridget ahead of him and depressed the trigger of the copperhead. The muzzle flash smeared the darkness with strobing tongues of flame. Kane knew that a sustained full-auto burst only wasted ammunition, but his focus was on driving away the Carnobot long enough so they could close and dog the hatch. He fired the clip dry and achieved his objective. The monster mechanoid did not advance from the gloom. Kane threw himself backward, and Grant pulled the hatch closed. Eduardo swiftly dogged it. A wire-encased bulb on the ceiling shed a ghostly illumination. They didn't stand in a room or even a corridor. It was more of a ribbed chute stretching away to a steel-sheathed door about 20 yards away. Kane gulped air, leaning against the hatch. A heavy weight slammed against it from the outside, causing it to rattle loudly in its frame. He and his friends hastily backed away from it. Eduardo turned and began jogging along the chute, but not with a panicked gait. He seemed more confident.
Come on!
At the end of the chute, they saw the door panel slide aside.
It's me! All clear?
A vibrant male voice replied from behind the door.
All clear.
Bridget, Kane, and Grant followed Eduardo down the chute and through the open doorway. They had no time to look before a multitude of gun barrels converged on them from all sides, staring like hollow eyes. Neither Grant, Bridget, nor Kane raised their hands. The four people in the habitat didn't see Kane and Grant flex the tendons of their right wrists, nor did they appear to hear the actuators click or the faint, brief drone of tiny electric motors and the solid slap of the butts of the sin-eaters sliding into the men's palms almost at the same time. But when they saw the hand blasters appear almost magically in their hands, they took instinctive steps back.
They're friends. At least, I think they are.
He cast a quizzical glance toward Bridget.
Aren't you?
For the time being. That all depends on what you tell us.
For a long tick of time, the tense tableau held. The gun-brandishing trio was attired similarly to Eduardo, though their coveralls were all of different colors, red, green, and gray. A woman wearing the red garment stepped around Eduardo, lowering her pistol.
All right. Everybody can stand down.
Her voice was strong and vibrant and carried a note of command.
My name is Mariah.
She wasn't beautiful or young. Her face was pale and angular. Her chestnut hair, threaded here and there with gray, was cut painfully short to the scalp. Deep creases curved out from either side of her nose to the corners of her mouth. Dark-ringed brown eyes gazed at them from beneath long brows that hadn't been plucked in years, if ever. Her teeth, though white, were uneven.
What are your names?
After the Cerberus exiles introduced themselves, she identified the other two people. Newkirk was a short, chunky man with weather-beaten features and a white crew cut. He wore the gray coverall. The man in green was introduced as Phil Boyd. He was the tallest of the group, a little over 6 feet, long and lanky of build. Blonde-white hair was swept back from a receding hairline. He wore black-rimmed eyeglasses. The right lens showed a spiderweb pattern of cracks. His cheeks appeared to be pitted with the sort of scars associated with chronic teenage acne.
Those outfits of yours threw us for a second. Only the Furies wear them. Where'd you find them?
Earth.
Kane stated this matter-of-factly, expecting all of the people to gape at him in shock or call him a liar. His one-word response didn't elicit either of those two reactions.
That's where we're from.
Fulboyd nodded sagely.
Yeah, had to happen eventually, I guess.
What had to happen?
That Earth people, what's left of them anyway, would finally remember we were up here.
A bitter, humorless smile twisted his thin lips.
A little too late.
In the moment of awkward silence that followed Philboyd's remark, Bridget glanced around the cylindrical interior of the habitat. She heard oxygen hissing through wall pipes. Indicator lights on a communications console blinked purposefully. The place seemed in perfect operational order. In an open cubicle, draped over frameworks, she saw several one-piece suits made of a silver material. Helmets with transparent visors rested on a shelf above them. She recognized the suits and helmets from pics she had seen as environmental suits.
You seem a little disappointed that we weren't all struck speechless when you said you were from Earth.
Not disappointed, necessarily. We're a little surprised, that's all. After all, you people have been up here for a couple of hundred years at least, or the people you're descended from.
Newkirk spoke up first. My parents were farmers in Iowa. Eduardo gestured to his three companions.
We've been up here since the 2nd of January, 2001, but we slept through most of those 2 centuries.
Grant drew in a sharp, startled breath.
You're freezies.
Eduardo chuckled, then winced, clutching at his chest. He sank down in a chair.
That's a good one. Freezies. Sounds like something you'd buy from an ice cream truck during the summer.
Phil Boyd apparently took offense.
If you mean we were in cryostasis, then yes, that's who we are.
That's who you are, maybe, but not what.
Mariah stepped forward, extending a hand toward Brigid.
Us? We used to be the project overseers of the devil process, but now we're all that stands between Earth and its obliteration. Pleased to meet you.
Grant and Kane retracted their sin-eaters, and Brigid returned Eduardo's pistol to him.
What kind of blasters are those, anyway? Never seen anything like them.
Mariah hesitated a moment, then handed her pistol to Grant, butt first.
They fire steel and tungsten carbide pellet loads. A unit of energy inside the grip moves a piston that propels the projectile. They're a sort of dial-a-recoil gas system to minimize the force with which the shooter would be moved backward in low or null gravity fields.
Too much recoil out on the surface, and the shooter could find himself halfway across the moon.
Exactly. There are some 3-piece plasma rifles on the base, but the pistol system proved the best. Radiation or energy-based weapons can be dangerous to the user.
Grant turned the gun over in his hands, squinted down its length, then handed it back to Mariah with a word of thanks. The atmosphere in the little hutch became less tense, but not particularly relaxed, even when everyone took chairs. Kane cast a wary glance toward the flimsy-looking door.
What's keeping those carnivorous droids, or furies, from breaking in here?
Newkirk gestured to the consoles. We modified one of these stations to triangulate and control the Devil platform's position. She doesn't know which hutch has the modifications, so she can't take the chance of damaging any one of them. It's sort of a no-man's land. She does know that if she happens to break into any of the habitats we occupy, she's taking a big risk.
Just what goes on here, anyhow?
You first. How'd you get here?
Grant and Kane let Brigid make the explanations. Tersely, without elaboration, she told of their first encounter with Majira and her Furies in Chicago, where they had embarked on a campaign of sin-cleansing. She related how Sindri had apparently brought her there during his experiments with the Parallax Points program, and how they had repeated his mistake. Although she alluded to Cerberus, she didn't go into detail or mention any names. The four people listened to the story with stolid expressions, occasionally interjecting a question. Kane noticed their questions were strangely free of anything pertaining to current conditions on Earth. For that matter, they didn't seem too surprised by anything Brigid told them. What happened to this Sindri fellow?
We don't know. We still don't know why Majira believed him to be a small, smiling god. I mean, he's small, and he smiles a lot, but a deity is the last thing he is.
It's all part of Majira's insane mythography. Grafting bits and pieces of old religions into her own, like she's sewing a quilt.
I noted how she had appropriated the Greek myth of the Furies and the Ubulus, even though the rest of her trappings are of Sumerian origin.
Is there a small, smiling god in Sumerian myth? Somebody she could have mistook Sindri for?
Eduardo shrugged again as if the matter were of little importance.
Adad, a dwarfish cousin of Enlil, is the best candidate. Oh, good thing the Sindri really wasn't who Majira thought he was. One Sumerian god up here is enough.
A chill finger stroked the buttons of Kane's spine.
So there really is an Anunnaki here on the moon?
He didn't ask a question, but made a statement, waiting for either confirmation or denial. For the first time, the four people displayed a strong reaction.
You know of the Anunnaki?
Yes. Briefly, the Anunnaki were intelligent alien beings with space travel capability. They perfected a method of hyperdimensional travel. They first visited Earth at least 300,000 years ago.
Enlil.
I was trying to be brief. Enlil was an Anunnaki who apparently held lordship over the Earth. He arranged the first catastrophe recorded in ancient texts as the Flood. He didn't want to leave Earth, and he died there. We saw his body.
Mariah sighed heavily, bowing her head and dry-scrubbing her scalp with her fingers.
Body, you say? He's not alive?
As far as we know, he's most completely, thoroughly dead.
Oh, thank God. Thank God for that, at least. We were terrified that he was here and we just couldn't find him. We found the rest of the Pantheon, but...
He broke off suddenly, his eyes widening as if he realized he had said too much.
What do you mean by Pantheon?
Do you mean the royal family?
You expect us to believe you found a nest of Sumerian gods up here?
Philboyd's eyes flashed with sudden sparks of anger.
Hey, back off, man! We're scientists!
You're not sounding like it.
None of the four people said anything. They just looked at one another in discomfort, all but squirming in their chairs.
Time for your contribution to the story hour.
You want it from the beginning?
That would help.
All right. The effort to colonize the moon started with the landing of Apollo 11 in the summer of 1969. Other landings were scheduled from mid-1969 to 1972. The second, Apollo 12, aimed for the Maria on the western side of the moon. The third targeted a highland formation like the Fra Mauro crater in the western highland region. The fourth was aimed at the eastern cratered highlands near Censorinus. The fifth explored the region of the Littrow craters east of the Mare Serenitatis. The sixth, the great crater Tycho. The seventh landed on the volcanic domes of the Marius Hills. The eighth was aimed at Schroeder's Valley, where luminous gas emissions had been reported by Earth observers for more than a century. The ninth landing was in the Hyginus Rill, one of the most prominent fault-like structures on the moon. And the tenth was in Copernicus, where it was hoped that material blown out of the interior would be found. Apollo 17 was the end of the line. Officially. I was part of the 21st manned landing, here in the Menetius crater region. One the American public knew nothing about.
I was on that flight, too.
I was on the 26th.
I'm the latecomer. I didn't get here until after the Matrans unit was installed. I think that was the 30th manned landing.
Kane arched an eyebrow but said nothing. Mariah caught the brow motion.
Please don't expect us to explain the Matrans gateways. I barely understood it even after it was explained to me. I refused to use it. I preferred the 8-day flight back to Earth.
Yeah, I was a quantum physicist, and it was almost beyond me how the damn things worked. You'd have to ask the boy genius about it. And for that, you'd need a medium. Or a swami, since he was Indian. Kane saw that Bridget did her best to repress a smile.
We know what the Matrans units are. But the question begs to be asked...
Why didn't we use the one here to gate ourselves off this rock? First off, after the nuke, we figured we were safer here.
So you know about the nuke cost. I wasn't sure.
Mariah made a gesture toward the door and the chute beyond.
We watched it from where the hydroponic farm is now. Hell of a light show.
She smiled, but it didn't reach her eyes.
You don't seem too broken up about it.
It's been 200 years. A little late for a wake, don't you think?
Mariah shifted in her chair.
To be honest with you, a number of the base personnel went completely off the deep end. Some committed suicide, some simply took long walks outside, without wearing spacesuits. After a few years, a group of us, the main devil crew, decided to go into cryostasis to keep from straining the base's resources.
How long has the base been here?
Construction began in the late 1970s, after the shuttlecraft program kicked into gear. This site was chosen because the early Apollo missions reported a base had already existed here. There were chambers and tunnels dug into the regolith, the crater walls, that extended for miles.
At the time, God only knew how many thousands of years old the base was or who built it.
We found out later.
As Mariah described it, the objective of the Menetius base was twofold: to establish a self-sufficient colony and to provide a jumping-off point to ferry materials and personnel to build a space station on the moon's dark side. There were also agricultural and mining ventures. Construction of the base was an ongoing process, expanding it, improving it, modifying it. By the mid-1990s, there were over 300 more or less permanent residents. Around that time, another mission was attached to the base.
The deep electromotive valence induration lithospheromal process?
Almost right, but the E doesn't stand for electromotive.
No?
It did on paper, when it was sold to Congress as an experimental terraforming project. In its first incarnation, Devil involved the covert assembly in low moon orbit of a planetismal projectile, if you know the term.
I do.
It was designed to make the atmosphere of Venus habitable for colonization, But it, mutated.
Mutated?
Mutated into not just a travesty of the original project, but into a genocidal monster. It was a black project. There was no way Congress would have approved funding for a device that turned the workings of the universe inside out.
How could that happen?
Eduardo tried to force a grin.
When you change the E from electromotive to entropic.
Kane exchanged a puzzled glance with Bridget.
You're going to have to explain yourself.
Mariah arose from her chair and stepped over to the communications console. She flicked a pair of toggle switches, and a screen blurred with an image. For a long moment, Kane, Bridget, and Grant had no idea what they were looking at. It resembled nothing so much as a spherical mass made of rusting plates of metal. They could barely distinguish little directional antennas bristling from its surface.
It looks like junk.
It was supposed to. A bunch of space junk in parking orbit. Nobody would get suspicious.
Define nobody.
The Russians, for one. Investigators from our own government, for another.
Mariah manipulated a dial and magnified the image.
The real problem was launching the components from the base and assembling them in space without attracting attention.
Inset between the plates of rusted metal, they saw long, sleek, rocket-shaped assemblies and a complexity of machinery. Mariah touched the various components.
Nuke drivers, stabilizers, and calibration equipment.
Put them all together and it spells devil. As in taking the hindmost, or in extreme cases, in a blue dress.
Kane cast the man an annoyed glance, but he didn't appear to notice. Mariah sighed heavily, unhappily.
The true meaning of the devil acronym was always deep entropic valence in duration lithospheromal. Only the designers and the operations team knew that. Essentially, Devil was built as an encapsulated, speeded-up manifestation of the second law of thermodynamics, the law of increasing entropy.
Entropy describes a process by which the universe is slowly running down, so slowly that it can only be measured in terms of centuries. Every particle of matter is losing energy, and this energy, in the form of heat and light, gradually accumulates throughout the universe. The rate at which bodies lose their energy is the entropic gradient. It appears that this process is also part of the process that we call the passage of time, or our perception of its passage. The entropic gradient is steady and inexorable.
All transfers of energy in our universe are controlled by the laws of thermodynamics. The first law states that mass, energy, cannot be created or destroyed. The second law adds that the disorganization or entropy of the universe increases with every energy transfer. Some energy is always degraded to useless heat dissipation.
And?
And the beginning of the universe, or the Big Bang, displayed a jolt of anti-entropy, resulting in increased complexity of mass. After the Big Bang, expansion of mass began to slow and reverse itself. When the mass catches up with the slowing expansion, the law of entropy applies.
Mariah smiled at her approvingly.
Theoretically, entropy would cause the dimming of stars for lack of fuel. They would become black dwarfs, neutron stars, or black holes. Multiple collisions between these neutron stars will form supermassive black holes whose gravity will suck in everything until there is no matter, no radiation, nothing. Entropy at its maximum is non-existence. But the holes decay faster than they shrink. Their lifetime is only about a second. The phenomenon depends not just on density, but on total mass, so there is not a singularity at the center.
Bridget's shoulders stiffened as she straightened swiftly in her chair. Kane and Grant could easily assess her sudden fear from her body language, even though her face remained calm and her tone uninflected.
Please tell me that does not mean what I think it does.
As if they were performers in a stage act, Phil Boyd, Newkirk, Mariah, and Eduardo all nodded at the same time. Their expressions were all of a type as well, grim. Eduardo was the first to answer her.
I'm afraid it does.
What are you talking about? It makes everything slow down?
It makes everything slow down and decay, just like that.
The sun could conceivably age billions of years in a second.
Mariah's voice was a flat, unemotional monotone, a direct counterpoint to the fright gleaming in her eyes.
It would not be able to support life on Earth.
Transliteration is one term for it. Spatial discontinuity is another. Whatever you call it, total annihilation is the end result.
Grant stood so suddenly his chair rolled backward on squealing casters, bumping into a console. He looked frightened and angry because of it. He raked the four scientists with furious eyes.
God damn white coats. Why would you build something like that?
Eduardo, Mariah, Newkirk, and Phil Boyd all looked at one another nervously. For a long moment, none of them spoke.
We didn't. Enki did.
Phil Boyd called the little plane a flitter gig, even though its official designation was a TAV, a trans-atmospheric vehicle. It was well over 200 years old, but he was obviously proud of it, despite the fact that one turbo ramjet repeller didn't work, causing the small 6-meter-long craft to list dangerously to port. At some time in the past, Phil Boyd had removed the control console and replaced it with a jury-rigged tangle of raggedly spliced wires and naked circuit boards. The astrophysicist explained that 3 of the TAVs out of a fleet of 10 survived on the base. All the others had been damaged in accidents over the years, and his flitter gig was one of them. It was little more than a wedge with curves, a javelin equipped with 2 different kinds of engines, a ramjet and rocket engines that worked in tandem to enable the craft to fly in a vacuum. Phil Boyd steered the flitter gig with a joystick-type contrivance, and he leaned forward in the uncomfortable bucket seat to peer through the sand-scoured and cracked canopy.
"Found this in the salvage yard about 2 years ago."
His voice echoed within the confines of the helmets Brigid, Kane, and Grant wore.
"A real classic. One of the secret prototypes made by High Flight Industries back in the 1990s. Of course, I don't expect the post-nuke generations to appreciate something like this. You gotta really love seat-of-the-pants flying to park your ass in one of these babies."
Kane wondered briefly how Grant, an experienced deathbird jockey, would respond to such a challenge, or what swear word Wegman would evoke upon first spying the craft. From the rear, he heard Brigid murmuring something about function without form. Or was that form without function?
"Look over there."
He pointed to the south.
"We call it the Wildlands."
They saw a tumbled, rocky wilderness of the great southwest crater region. In the naked glow of starlight, the tightly clustered craters presented a forbidding spectacle. Everywhere the lunar plains and deserts were cracked by deep fissures.
"That's where most of the mining operations were conducted. See that? One of the greatest wonders of the moon."
Brigid, Kane, and Grant craned their necks, peering to see through the canopy. In the distance, a great slash curved through the barren lunar plain, wide and cut in clean like a surgical incision. It was an enormous, yawning chasm that stretched out of sight from east to west. Its sheer rock sides dropped into an impenetrable darkness of inestimable depth.
"The Great Chasm. 800 miles long, nearly 50 miles wide. It makes the Grand Canyon look like a pothole. God only knows how deep it is, but it's honeycombed by tunnels and hollows shaped by unequal cooling eons ago."
"Cooling? Cooling down from what?"
"There are numerous theories about the origin of the moon. One is the fission theory, in which part of the rapidly spinning Earth was flung off to create the moon. Another version of the fission theory stated that the moon originated from the Pacific Ocean."
Phil Boyd nodded inside his helmet. His lips were creased in an approving smile.
"Huh.
And here I pretty much convinced myself that the descendants of the war were going to be as well-read as your average heavy metal fan. I'm glad to be proved wrong. Anyway, if the fission theory is correct, then there would have been a lot of volcanic activity here."
Phil Boyd turned the craft a few degrees to starboard.
"Look over there, to the left of the chasm. There's your evidence of volcanism."
Kane looked and saw nothing at first. Then light flashed, white and bright. It was like sunlight reflecting from an immense, highly polished surface.
"Mare Frigoris, the sea of ice. Pumice fused into glass. In a couple of hours, it'll be like a giant mirror."
The flitter gig returned to its original course, arrowing between a pair of conical peaks. On the other side lay the grounds of the mine. Huge, dirty ore processing structures shouldered the open sky. Skeletal frameworks stretched this way and that between gargantuan storage bins. In the starlight, the mine looked oddly unfinished, like the foundations of a city someone might get around to building one day. Phil Boyd slowed their speed and went into a vertical descent. He set the flitter gig down on a flat concrete pad opposite a flat-roofed building marked Operations. There were no windows, only an exterior airlock bearing the warning, "Authorized Space Command Personnel Only."
"You expect us to moonwalk over there?"
"Why not? The flitter gig isn't pressurized, and you survived the flight, didn't you? Besides, it's only 1/6 of a G. You won't go floating out into space."
Phil Boyd throttled down the engines. Inside his helmet, Kane heard an almost imperceptible grunt from Grant. even over the whisper of oxygen feeding from the twin tanks on his back. During the flight from Menetius, he had heard the soft clicking of an apparatus that cleared out the toxic residues in the recycled air. All four people wore EVA suits, routinely known in old NASA vernacular as extravehicular activity suits. At least Mariah referred to it as vernacular, referring to a time when tramping around in the hard vacuum of the moon's surface was something not lightly done. In actuality, the one-piece garments were not too different from the environmental suits found in Cerberus Redoubt. They weighed about 30 pounds apiece and consisted of 10 layers of aluminized mylar insulation interlaced with 6 layers of Dacron and tough outer facings of Kevlar to absorb micrometeorites. The EVA suits had been designed to create microenvironments, pressuring the skin so the pressure of the body would not rupture blood vessels. They even came equipped with a sealed water dispenser and sipping tube attached to the inner wall of the helmet. The wearers' heads moved freely within the helmets. The plexiglass visors instantly adjusted to different light levels, and all four people communicated over UTEL radio systems. Filboid slid open the canopy, and he, Grant, Kane, and Bridget climbed out. Kane looked toward the looming storage bins and repressed a shiver. Seemingly perched atop a lunar peak, like a ball, was the blue-white globe of the Earth. A couple of years before, he had seen a satellite view of Earth. Now, as then, he was filled with awe and a sense of despair. Earth seemed shadowy, dim, with a lost look to it, as though the universe had forgotten about it long ago. He saw large areas of the planet lying under an impenetrable belt of dust and debris. In some places, the belt looked like a dense blanket of boiling, red-tinged fog. The clouds were the last vestiges of sky dark, the generation-long nuclear winter. The four people trekked the 50 yards to the airlock. Kane kept stifling the impulse to take Bridget's gloved hand as they walked over the open lunar terrain, and his steps kept lifting him into ungainly hops. He and Grant had left their copperheads in the flitter gig, but their sin-eaters were strapped around their forearms. Their weight provided a degree of ballast, though the actuators weren't as sensitive through the layers of their EVA suits. The lock system wasn't particularly complex. Filboid punched in a series of digits on the keypad beside it, and two gasketed irises slid open. They stepped inside a narrow cubicle as the lock closed behind them. They faced a metal disc, surrounded by a thick collar gleaming like copper. A light fixture above it flashed green, and the metal disc rolled to the left, into a slot inside the collar.
It's safe to take off your helmets.
They all stepped out of the cubicle, disengaging the seals and lifting the helmets off their heads. They looked around the room, which once had served as the main operation center for the aluminum mine. The air smelled stale and sour. There were a dozen desks, most of them covered with computer microtapes, notebooks, and printouts. Bridget moved to a computer terminal and pressed the activation tab.
The main database is still accessible. The rest of you might as well make yourselves comfortable. This is going to take a little while.
Filboid, Grant, and Kane found chairs and sat down. In Earth normal gravity, the suits had become uncomfortably heavy. Kane glanced over at Filboid.
You can finish up your history lesson, as long as we've got the time.
Like Mariah said, most of it is speculation. We really don't know all the details.
Tell us anyway.
Grant rotated his helmet between his big, gauntleted hands. Filboid shrugged. The four astrophysicists had provided a fragmented backstory, a tapestry wherein scientific principle was threaded with superstition and interwoven with insanity.
Well, like I said, after the war, what you call the new cost, all of us here tried to come to terms with being marooned, that there would be no rescue missions. Most of us had spent years on the moon anyway, so it wasn't that big of a stretch. But for some of us here, well, there's that old saying, if you can't adapt, you die.
Even before the nuke cost forever separated 330 human beings 238,866 miles from the world of their birth, Menetius Base was divided into two castes, the support personnel with the military among them, and the scientists. Unsurprisingly, the scientists composed the elite of the new society, and for a few years following the nuke cost, the two groups dwelt in peace, practicing a form of democracy. But the physicists, who had labored for years on the Devil Project to the exclusion of all else, became obsessed with deactivating it. The rest of the base's inhabitants had no idea that the focus of the project had changed from terraforming, and they couldn't understand why the device wasn't put to use in restoring health to the nuke-ravaged Earth. The disagreements boiled over into dissension. The military and support people reached the conclusion that since scientists had brought on the Holocaust and scientists were withholding the means to reverse its effects, scientists should have no part of the new lunar society.
Once those assholes got around to building one, that is.
Apparently, they did.
They were more interested in destroying the old, from what I remember. Already, even in the days when everybody more or less got along, the base was divided between the two factions. My group withdrew into a quarter of the installation where we worked on trying to figure out a way to either deactivate Devil or bring it down. We were getting close, and then everything turned to shit.
How so?
Face set in a grim mask, Phil Boyd told how all their efforts were undone by one of their own fellow scientists, a woman named Ceramus. In the years preceding the new cost, she served as Manetius's chief geologist and historian. She had made the initial discoveries that a highly developed race had, in ages past, planted a colony on the moon. She continued her work even after the nuke cost. She had already uncovered the clues that indicated the existence of a hidden city. Ceramus and a group of followers performed excavations in the so-called wildlands, and she discovered secrets about the moon she never told anyone. She found tunnels and passages that led to the crypts of the Serpent Kings, the Anunnaki. She plundered the tombs of their dead and stole much of their technology. Ceramus claimed that a vast, lost knowledge was hidden in those catacombs, that on the moon were secrets that were old when Sumeria was new, that were ancient when the pyramids were built in Egypt. She lost herself completely in the ancient culture of the Anunnaki.
Ceramus found one of the great science centers of ancient days, apparently a citadel of some kind. She and her crew would come back here for supplies, eat and drink, and wouldn't answer questions. She'd just stare at us when we asked what she was doing, then go back out there. This went on for weeks, for months. Then one day, she went out and didn't come back.
You never saw her again?
Not as Ceramus. But we saw her as Majira.
Majira is a Freezy like you?
Would you believe me if I tell you that I don't know if this particular Majira is the same as the original?
No. That's a convenient bit of ignorance, if you ask me.
Clasping his hands together, Phil Boyd slouched in his chair, hanging his head.
I don't know what to tell you, then. All I know is that a woman calling herself Majira, complete with a contingent of Furies wearing the black outfits you call shadow suits, invaded our part of the base. Those of us who resisted were killed, calcified by the Ubalus rods. The rest of us were pursued like deer all over the base.
In a rustling whisper, Phil Boyd told of terrifying pursuits, of ambushes on staircases, of his friends dying one by one, judged and turned to stone by Majira and her Furies.
Obviously, the Ubalus and the Shadow Suits had been found in the Citadel, but none of us knew where it was. But we do know Ceramus used this old mining center as her base of operations.
Who were the Furies?
Phil Boyd looked at Kane in surprise, as if he hadn't expected the question.
I presume people she swung to her cause.
You never saw their faces?
No, not then or now. They always wear those masks. Why do you ask?
Kane only shook his head. He remembered the dead Fury he had unmasked in Chicago, recalling its long-jawed, narrow-chinned, high-cheekboned face. He'd recognized the facial type. He had seen it often enough over the past couple of years, particularly during his captivity in Area 51. The Fury in Chicago had been a hybrid. If not a full-fledged one, then certainly some traces of Balaam's genetic material were buried in his familial woodpile. He had been much taller than the average hybrid, and his eyes hadn't possessed the prominent supraorbital ridge arches either. Lakesh had learned that the DNA of Balaam's folk was infinitely adaptable, malleable, its segments able to achieve a near-seamless sequencing pattern with whatever biological material was spliced to it. In some ways, it acted like a virus, overwriting other genetic codes, picking and choosing the best human qualities to enhance. Their DNA could be tinkered with to create endless variations, adjusted and fine-tuned. Strongbow had led them all to believe that Enlil's DNA possessed the same qualities, so it was possible the Furies were some mixture of human and Anunnaki.
Anyhow, after a couple of months, only me, Mariah, Eduardo, and Newkirk were left. They captured us, but they didn't kill us. They put us into cryostasis.
Grant's eyebrows knitted in confusion.
Why? Why didn't you get the same treatment as all the others?
Like I said, we four were the main Devil project team. Majira needed us. Or she figured she would need us at some future date, so we were put into storage.
And that date arrived?
We were revived a little over a year ago. The Devil Platform's positioning system had malfunctioned, and we were expected to fix it. We did, but we did more than that. We downloaded all the secondary analogs from our mainframes and changed all the access codes, targeting and trajectory programs, recognition signals and launch commands. All the primary codes have been rewritten, and any attempts to delete the new program results in an immediate lockout.
Nobody figured it out?
Phil Boyd's eyes narrowed.
Most of the old technical knowledge was lost during our 193 years in stasis. The descendants of the original base personnel know enough to keep certain important systems functioning, but that's about it.
How many people on the base now?
I never did get an accurate idea. Majira kept us isolated from the main population. It was only after she and her Furies disappeared for a while that we had the run of the place. Even then, those goddamn Carnobots kept us from going to a lot of the different sections.
Who made those things, anyway?
They were manufactured back before the Holocaust. They were field-tested up here. Sometime during our period in stasis, their programming was altered. I don't know what they were thinking when they did that.
They?
The new society that arose here. A kind of insane mixture of Sumerian mythology and old paganism, with a little nature worship thrown in. Well, something like that took hold is beyond me.
Thinking of the Valley of the Divinely Inspired, Kane smiled crookedly.
You'd be surprised how easy it is to create new and crazy societies.
That's true. The first step is to destroy the old one and old mindsets. The nuke cost did that for you. A completely new system of thinking, of believing, of dealing with everyday life was forced on the people up here. Their old mindsets were totally unsuitable to function within that new system. For a time, the changeover was held in check through force of habit. But in the long run, nothing short of a complete transformation of the way people perceived and processed reality would do. That appears to have happened while you were sleeping. All right, I think I've found what we were looking for.
Kane and Phil Boyd joined her at the machine. Words and numbers scrolled across the screen with a dizzying rapidity.
How the hell can you read anything at that speed?
This is a pretty old model. If I had the opportunity, I could upgrade the access and scroll time.
It took a couple of seconds for the meaning of Bridget's response to register with the man. When it did, Phil Boyd scowled and opened his mouth to speak, but Bridget brought the data stream to an abrupt halt. She tapped a series of numbers on the glowing screen with a forefinger.
Ceramis, or the original Majira, kept a log of her excavations and explorations, at least at the beginning. Here we have a set of coordinates that correspond to the location of the Great Chasm. It was there she found the passageway that led to the catacombs, and then later to the citadel of the Anunnaki.
And that's where she found all the technology she used to become Majira. And apparently, where she found the Anunnaki themselves, or at least one of them.
Enki, or so Ceramis would have had us believe. She claimed she found a god.
She must have been a hell of a scientist to assume an alien that looks like a lizard is a god.
The ruling council of the Anunnaki, according to myths, had locked Enki into a hidden tomb. She said she found it and released him.
You never saw him yourself?
Phil Boyd repressed a shudder.
Only from a distance. Majira spoke for him, saying Enki wanted the power of the devil returned to him.
Bridget pushed back her chair from the computer terminal.
If the hidden citadel of the Anunnaki actually exists here on the moon, Ceramis noted its coordinates. So that's where we'll go.
You know Majira and her people are looking for you. They know we took my flitter gig, and TAV patrols will be scouring the region. And I'll bet she has Carnobot stationed around the chasm.
You don't have to go with us.
I wasn't intending to.
You're that scared of her?
The man's eyes flashed with sudden anger behind the lenses of his glasses.
Yes, but that doesn't have anything to do with my decision. As long as I'm alive, the Devil Platform can be permanently deactivated. If I'm killed, goodbye and thanks for all the fish.
None of the three people knew the meaning of his bromide, and they weren't inclined to ask. Phil Boyd took his chair again.
I'll just sit here and wait. That is, if you can find your way out of the chasm. Getting in is no big deal.
Bridget, Grant, and Kane exchanged long glances.
How do you propose we get to the chasm?
Phil Boyd smiled a little mockingly.
You know how to fly, don't you?